Welcome to The B-Side, a podcast by Black sociologists that engages thinkers at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, history, social life, and just about everything, actually.
And anything. Anything vaguely Black.
Exactly.
Or not even, actually. Anything.
Blackish.
Blackish, exactly. And what's not Blackish?
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
I'm Corey Fields, also coming to you from Georgetown.
And so, as the name suggests, each week we feature one of our favorite B-side recordings. And this week, No, Your Ears Did Not Deceive, Push It was an originally a B-side release by Salt-N-Pepa in 1986. And if you can guess what the A-side track was, Corey and I will let you buy us a drink at the ASAs in August.
Nice. Please, yes. Send your responses. And this is an everybody can win kind of contest. So everybody who gets it right is welcome to buy us a drink in Philly. So please.
Or two, or five.
Or six. Just push it on to us. We'll happily drink it. That's so crazy about Push It, though, because it's definitely, unquestionably, the song that blew up Salt-N-Pepa, right? With Push It. And it was kind of like a little hidden B-side track that the people fell in love with and made it sort of A-side. So, yeah.
Well, you see, sometimes what you think is A material is not. And what you think is B material is not. Just saying.
Well, we definitely have A material today for the show.
Yes, yes, we do. Joining us this week are our guests, Waverly Duck from the University of Pittsburgh and James Jones from Rutgers University, Newark. Welcome you two.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming. So as we like to do, Corey and I would like the listeners to know what you're up to these days. So Waverly, would you like to start?
Oh, what am I not up to? So at this moment... So at this moment in time, I am finishing up a number of projects, and I think... this tends to happen after you get a promotion, you promise to do all these things, and then all of a sudden you're busy. So I'm finishing up a book on unconscious racism and how to see it, and looking at everything from how race works in the workplace for upwardly mobile Black folks, to racism on college campuses, to greeting sequences amongst women, how race works in the doctor's office, but also, and I think one of my sort of favorite chapters is how it works in everyday life. So even looking at citizen police interaction, I'm also doing some interesting stuff on autism, looking at autism testing and diagnoses, pretty much how kids who are verbally fluent, high functioning kids on the autism spectrum, how they answer questions about emotions and are taking for granted notions about how we talk about emotions. In a lot of ways, when we talk about emotions, we tend to use metaphors. So if I were to ask like Corey or James or Leslie, how do you feel inside when you're happy, sad, or angry? You would probably use some metaphor to describe it. And what we notice is that kids on the spectrum tend to be very literal in their description of emotions, but they also develop these really creative strategies of figuring out what the expected response is. And then my guilty pleasure right now, I think a number of people have heard of food deserts. Mm-hmm. So I'm studying food oases, looking at how three or more supermarkets cluster together. And in this case, I'm doing a single case study in Pittsburgh, looking at eight supermarkets within a quarter mile radius in this predominantly poor Black neighborhood. But the flip side to it is that this neighborhood is in proximity to some of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Pittsburgh. And so we're looking at, on a qualitative level, do people still have trouble with access being in proximity to these supermarkets? The giveaway is yes. It's more of a, you know, economic challenges that's interfering with people having access to food. And then the second thing that I think is really interesting and edgy Because supermarkets are sort of a type of subsistence sort of business, how does, and in Pittsburgh, there are a number of food deserts, but how does a community end up with 8 supermarkets? So looking at that entire process from talking to developers, politicians, community development organizations, to explain how something like that happens. And, you know, I'll just give away a few features of this. Free or cheap real estate, a cheap labor force, security and parking, and being in proximity to wealth are key ingredients to building a food oasis.
So wait, so it's kind of like all the grocery stores have been, what's the term I'm looking for? I want to say ghettoized, but that's not really what I'm looking for. But they're all in like one sort of poorest neighborhood. And then, but they're adjacent to nice neighborhoods. So it's kind of like the neighborhood is providing this service of hosting all the grocery stores.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, what the mayor proposed, what I thought was really provocative as he was talking to developers, he first tried this with Home Depot. And he convinced Home Depot to build a store in Pittsburgh. And usually Home Depot historically have built stores in suburban communities. And that Home Depot became the best performing Home Depot in the country. And what was interesting about it, that once you started building the, not only the Home Depot and these series of supermarkets, it literally transformed the surrounding communities. So yes, it attracted these wealthy buyers. But also, I think it sort of caused property values to go up. It triggered other types of development. So in addition to the 7 supermarkets, those that really chic eyeglass company, is it Wallaby Parker?
Warby Parker.
That's a sign that your neighborhood is on the ups and up, on the up and up. And so there's, in this neighborhood, there's a Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, Aldi's, Giant Eagle Market, Giant Eagle Shakespeare. That's a local Pittsburgh chain, a food co-op. And I'm missing one. A Super Target. So in addition to a cadre of like dollar stores. So it's a really interesting thing to study in terms of understanding development, but also how people with resources can actually gentrify a neighborhood. And then it brings into question like who actually have the economic resources to transform housing, to put those supermarkets there, and the political and the economic know-how to sort of get buyers and investors to sort of do that type of development.
Waverly, and I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but I'm wondering, were these businesses able to sort of get anything from the Community Reinvestment Act?
Yes, no. There are a couple clever things that took place in this neighborhood. So one of the things that happened while all of this development initially started taking place, we had a lot of deconcentrating poverty and the movement through Section 8 to tear down, you know, high-rise housing projects. And I think one of the sort of latent benefits that came out of sort of redeveloping this neighborhood and building these supermarkets and these stores and displacing and relocating people was that a community benefits agreement was sort of inserted for at least 4 of the supermarkets. So the Target, the Whole Foods, the Trader Joe's, and the Aldi's all have a community benefits agreement where they have to hire within this catchment area. In this very subtle way, and it doesn't happen for a lot of the homeowners, but the people who were allowed to stay, and I'm being very specific how I say this, the people who were allowed to stay actually witnessed their household incomes going up. Beyond that, if you take in consideration the number of people who were displaced, it's kind of, I'm not sure if it's a glass half empty or half full, but it was a strategic plan that's been 30 years in the works to sort of redevelop and transform this neighborhood. And it took somebody who was slightly clever in terms of, I have no idea what is this. My computer is being attacked. What was interesting about this is that this was 30 years in the works. And so these plans about having somebody who was really clever and showing using GIS mapping of that you have at least four of the wealthiest communities to the south of this neighborhood. You have two very wealthy suburban neighborhoods to the north. And then there's a really wealthy or at least a solidly middle-class Black neighborhood to the east and downtown to the west. A picture starts forming of making the case. So yes, a lot of those policies were sort of used to sort of trigger investment. But also, I think regardless, this was a target for redevelopment for over 30 years.
Huh. Well, you sound crazy busy, Waverly. So we really appreciate you taking the time out to be with us today. And so, James, what about you? What are you up to?
So currently I'm working on my book project, The Last Plantation. So for me, I am really interested in the intersection of race and politics, but through a sociological lens. So the animating questions that I'm most likely interested in is looking at the organizing role of race and American democratic institutions and the mechanisms that produce and reproduce racial inequality. So from my perspective, I think the experiences of African-Americans professionals in government is a way to not only see inequality within it, but to sort of explicate the relationship between race and power and what I deem are these sort of racialized governing institutions. So currently I am on the very, very, very last stages of an article that looks at the racial politics of congressional cafeterias as a way of excavating the informal racial structure of Congress. So on...
all the Black workers sit together in the cafeteria.
I mean, so yes, why do all the Black people sit together in the congressional cafeterias? But the more important question is, why are all the white people in the Congress sitting together as well, right? But so, you know, I think the cafeteria is this really unconventional place to look at to try and understand race and politics in Congress. But it has this really fascinating 150-year history, even more than that, actually, of really interesting racial politics. And for me, I'm interested in workers, not necessarily members of Congress. Because if you think about it, members of Congress, Black members of Congress, have not always been in the legislature. We get them during Reconstruction, and then we have this sort of this nadir that begins in 1901 and till 1930. And so there's no Black members of Congress until you have Oscar DePreez in 1929. And then you always have a Black member of Congress and it sort of grows in size. But if you think about it, Black employees have always been there from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. They were slaves, they were messengers, mm-hmm. They were bathroom attendants, they worked in the cafeterias, they were always there. So if you really want to get the story of how race shapes what goes on in Congress, to me, you have to look at Black workers. So looking right. at the experiences of those who work in the cafeterias, beginning in Reconstruction, you sort of see this uneven march towards racial progress, if you can even call it that. And so you sort of start off in Reconstruction with members of Congress wanting to employ Blacks because they are now citizens. And you know, you have to be responsible to your constituents. And then you sort of see the ways in which white supremacy sort of gets institutionalized in Congress as history sort of progresses. And so you sort of see Blacks sort of be limited to only positions in the cafeteria, but also the ways in which the racial order is practiced in Congress. It's really reminiscent of a Southern order. And so you can sort of get to sort of have this sort of Jim Crow atmosphere in Congress through this more socialized or this sort of social in a socialized way.
You know what? Sorry. No, go ahead. I was just thinking of something. Go ahead.
Go for it.
Oh, so I was going to say, well, this reminds me of two things. Number one, I mean, to be sociological, it reminds me of Penelope Eckert's book, Jocks and Burnouts, you know, where she talks about high school culture. And, you know, and she talks a lot about, she has that one chapter where she talks, well, throughout the book, she talks about how students from different socioeconomic classes, which gets reproduced within the culture of the school, you know, as either your jock, which means you're close to power in terms mm-hmm. of the school, and you supposedly buy school culture, and then the burnouts who tend to come from working class homes and who don't seem as or don't feel as valued by the school as the jocks do, inhabit these different spaces that actually in many ways shows the outside world like basically what your value is in the school, right? And in you can see that in the cafeteria as well, which then makes me think that, you know, I think Tina Fey must have read that book when she wrote Mean Girls, right? Because remember in Mean Girls when she has that whole mapping of the school cafeteria, right? Yeah. So is there a similar mapping in the cafeteria?
Well, definitely. You always have so many different personalities that converge in the cafeteria, right? And so in each different racial epic that I'm following, the way that the cafeteria is set up changes, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have this really, really progressive and radical moment during Reconstruction in which the cafeteria is a sort of egalitarian space. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of get to the New Deal era, and this is when segregation becomes to become institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And so you have this both happening with more Black members coming to Congress, but also Black professionals actually entering Congress for the first time. And so when Oscar DePriest, the congressman from Chicago, goes to the members' dining room, you know, there's like white flight in Congress. Like all the white representatives flees the Senate because they don't want to dine with Oscar DePriest. And, you know, there is literally a separate cafeteria for Black workers. And then there's just this huge moment of protest that's covered in the Times. And it's actually sort of amplified by like people like Ralph Bunche and other Howard University students and faculty to really integrate the cafeteria. Because as Oscar DePriest says, if you can't find freedom under the Capitol Dome, where are you going to find it? And so this is a really interesting link about the politics that happened in Congress and how that sort of relates to the broader civil rights movement. But also, as I sort of found in this sort of post-civil rights era, we think that everything is all good because we have people at the top. But again, the cafeteria is this interesting moment, and you sort of have this bifurcation in the Black community where you have Black elites at the top and they're sort of this visible sign of racial progress. But then you still have this group who is the most likely to get discriminated against, who doesn't have the right to unionize, and who's really subject to unfair working conditions. And so what happens is Congress it privatizes his workplace as a way of punishing those who are fighting for more for greater workplace rights. And this is where they get the nickname the Last Plantation, because Congress is one of the last places where it's actually legal to discriminate. So in the 1960s, you know, Congress passes the Civil Rights Act. It removes many barriers for white women and people of color to get jobs and or go to school. But of all of those workplaces, you know, Congress is the one that is exempted from that, right? Because, you know, you would have the executive branch overseeing it. So there is this sort of justification that we need to have a separation of power. So therefore, these laws cannot apply to Congress. But in many ways, what that does is further instantiate racial inequality. And so that's more of the stuff that I'm trying to sort of parse out in the book.
Yeah, that's
cool. That sounds interesting. I mean, the other thing that's kind of cool about it is it's a context where you can also explore sort of intra-group differences, right? So I imagine the experience of race is very different for like sort of high-level aides or even Black congressional members than it is for like low-level workers, but everyone's occupying the cafeteria space. There's overlap between them. So that's one fascinating aspect about this, because I have to guess what it means to be Black. There's some consistency irrespective of where you are in the organization, but there has to be some variation depending on like your level or your status.
Yeah, so there's like it's really interesting to like look at intergroup variation, as you sort of mentioned, and I sort of do that, but you would be surprised to like know that there actually isn't that much social distance based upon your occupation. Right. And so in one paper that I have at the Du Bois Review, I look at this through the presence of the black nod, right? You know, that sort of subtle gesture that you do to sort of see, signal that, hey, I see you. And, you know, it's right. interesting that people are really adamant about doing this, particularly between high status and low status work as a way of sort of indicating like linked fate, but also going across party mm-hmm. lines. It's like, hey, I'm going to nod to the black Republican if I'm a Democrat because I know they got it bad. And then the black Republican is going to say, hey, I'm going to nod to the black Democrat because, hey, I know you got it bad, right? because, you know, Republicans are not the only problem that's party is dealing with racism. And so there's this really right. strong community there. But it's also a way of understanding how people actually do race, right? What does it mean to be black? Mm-hmm. How do you perform your blackness? How does this become integrated into your professional identity?
Yeah.
And all those things.
Cool stuff all around. See, everybody's so interesting when they come on the B side.
Well, I mean, I assume that they're interesting even when they're not on the B side, correct?
All problems, of course, but that's why they're on. Yeah,
but we are happy you're here, not just to talk about the work that you're doing, which sounds great, but also because we love having smart people on to help us talk through and think through what's been going on in the past week. So, Corey, what should we talk about? What should we talk about? What's been going on?
There's a lot that's been going on. So I figured, well, I kind of want to talk about Sacramento. It's a little sort of, you know, I guess a downer, if you will, topic, but it feels like hard to ignore. So Sacramento. So this is the Stephon Clark yeah. shooting that's been all over the news. Right. So this guy, you know, in his backyard, holding a cell phone. Obviously, there's like multiple versions or multiple stories about what happened, right? But the end result of it was right. So there's the police shoot him in his backyard. I guess he's a suspect in like window smashing or something. Although the story feels unclear at this point. And, but again, it sort of falls back on this issue of like another police shooting. Right. And so, yeah, I was just curious. It's like what you guys have heard about it, what you guys thought about it, but also to think about it in like a larger context. Right. And more specifically, the context of sort of the Black Lives Matter movement and what do we think is happening with those politics and sort of what's going on with that? Because I've actually just been thinking it feels like the conversation has taken like a weird direction. Like, I don't even feel like there's like the pro-police pushback as strongly anymore. I think it's just kind of like everyone's like, oh yeah, these shootings are absolutely crazy and not cool. But then that's just sort of where the conversation ends, right? Which is like this weird Jedi mind trick from like those in power to just be like, okay, we aren't going to bother with bullshit pushback, but we're also not going to do anything that might, you know, change this situation. So I don't know.
Well, so I'm wondering how much part of that is, you know, Sacramento is at least on the surface supposed to be this kind of progressive city, right? Although,
I mean, I know it's like for one window is like pretty diverse, or like the population was sort of equally split. So it was like the same percentage black, same percentage Latino, same percentage Asian, and same percentage white,
if I'm not mistaken. But do they live near each other, Corey?
Well, if I'm to go on the movie Lady Bird, no. So I don't know how accurate a representation Lady Bird was of Sacramento, mm-hmm. but I didn't see any black people in it. Yeah. So I'm guessing that it's a pretty segregated city. I mean, it's outside of San Francisco, and I lived in San Francisco for a while, but people didn't spend a lot of time talking about Sacramento. But yeah, I think it's pretty segregated.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail.
No, that's okay. So, I mean, I think part of it is, I think it's meant to be, at least relatively speaking, progressive. And I think number two, I mean, I think that, I think that the mayor like had been like on board as being like, yes, we're, you know what, we're not going to let people burn anything down. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what I think he was thinking, because he was like, let's release those tapes right away and just let people take from it what they take from it. And then, of course, the family, they paid for, I don't know if they paid for it, but they got an independent coroner's report.
Right.
And the independent coroner, they basically concluded that that he was shot in the back 6 times.
Right. So, which doesn't match up with the, you know, stated police story so far.
I mean, this entire situation is, I mean, it's not only frustrating, it's infuriating. And the reason why, so first, in the context of the current President Trump's administration, so that's one layer. Then you have the Parkland shootings going on, so that's another layer. And then the ridiculousness of the situation. So I imagine that people care about their cars, but the fact that you know, that someone's breaking car windows at a helicopter and you have two armed police officers then rush into somebody's backyard and within 3 seconds of interacting with him, fire over 20 shots, that entire situation doesn't make sense. And I think what the historical record has shown us, and it doesn't, and I think it's irrelevant about how progressive Sacramento is, that there's an infrastructure in place that sort of protects law enforcement, that there's no accountability and there's no real legal recourse for a lot of people who are seeking justice. So if we look back at what's going to happen, probably some investigation is going to happen. There's probably going to be some lawsuit that comes into play. Maybe one of these officers will lose their job. But again, it doesn't get at the, you know, the crux of the issue about the value of Black life. And I think thinking about that entire situation that you can be executed in your backyard. And even comparing that to, you know, how we think about property. And the reason that I'm bringing up sort of Trump and the Parkland shootings is to sort of put this in context of what's the discourse right now. So I have yet to hear anything from this current administration about what's been happening, particularly in Sacramento. They've been very quiet about what's happening in Parkland, and even to talk about sort of racialized violence and what's happening in inner cities and police-citizen interaction, I think is really, really important. But I think the major issue is thinking about what is our, you know, what do citizens have in terms of legal recourse to deal with problematic police officers? And then again, thinking about, you know, why is this situation of understanding how do we address or how do we punish officers who have been found to, you know, be liable for wrongdoing? Now, I've watched the video. I looked at the helicopter footage. I find that situation extremely problematic. And another thing that I would add, that these shootings, doesn't seem like they're slowing down, that we've introduced body cams and we're still seeing this happen day after day after day. And so I think the questions that I think I would love for someone to address is that if you're a victim of police violence, what is your legal recourse beyond a lawsuit? And that's what I'm concerned about.
It seems like the recourses are actually getting slimmer and slimmer. Like there was just the Supreme Court, didn't they just reject mm-hmm. a case like just this week related to a police shooting? I want to say
Kessler.
Right. Where they're just sort of like the qualified immunity that the police get, you know, they upheld that. And this was a case where, you know, some lady was stabbing a tree with a knife, somebody called the cops, but then whatever passed and she was just standing there talking to her roommate and they shot her 4 times, you know, because they were like from a distance, like drop a knife and she didn't hear him or whatever. But she survived and then went on to sue. But then, you know, the officer was sort of saying that he was protected by qualified immunity. And the Ninth Circuit said, that's bullshit. But now the Supreme Court has said, no, it's not bullshit. He is protected, right? Which is just sort of, again, going back to this question of, like, what recourse do people have? And that might be why, you know, the conversation like the track, it never like holds traction. Well, I'm sure that's part of it also, like a deep disregard for Black life is part of it as well. But from like just a functional standpoint, it just feels like these cases never have anywhere to go, right? Like there's never any sort of like traction that gets held in. I think part of it's like, it would require having a serious conversation about police reform as well. So, and yeah.
What do you think, James?
So I'm glad that Corey, you brought up the Kessler versus Hughes case, right? And so this is a decision that, like, if I'm not mistaken, had no oral arguments, but that was just issued reversing the sort of the circuit decision by the Supreme Court. But I thought Sonia Sotomayor had an important dissent where she sort of teamed up with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And she sort of writes, it's a decision that's just not wrong in the law, but it also sends an alarming signal to law enforcement officers and the public. It tells officers that they can shoot first and think later. It tells the public palpably unreasonable conduct will go unpunished, right? But I think to Waverly's point, thinking about this current administration and their response or their lack of a response, in these moments, you know, I think you sort of, you have, you're missing President Obama a bit, right? Someone who can provide moral leadership.
Right, and but his take on these issues was often questionable at best. I mean, sort of.
Yeah, I think, yes, there were, right? But you had that moment with Trayvon Martin, right? Where he has two takes on the situation. And the first is that, you know, this Trayvon could have been my son, right? And then the second part is like, Trayvon, that could have been me. I think the third part that often doesn't get articulated is that Trayvon could have been President Obama, right? And so thinking about the value of Black life, there's no, the state doesn't see the value in these people and what these people can produce. And thinking about, I don't know, I think Black lives matter. So I think we're in an interesting moment where we see the state as violent, right? And I would certainly agree with that. I've been teaching a course all year called The American Racial State. And so, you know, I run with Charles Mills, and I sort of argue that white supremacy is a sort of unnamed political system that has made the modern world what it is today. And it's constituted this racialized state. And I think my students believe that. But I think there's also something that we have to recognize, that the state has power, and the state can actually do some type of radical things that can actually help Black lives. And so I think there is a nihilism that is infiltrated this generation, and we think the state has no solutions. But I think the state can actually do some really great things. So I think part of it is that, yes, we need to organize, we need to sort of mobilize on the sort of grassroots levels, but and challenge those who are in power. But I think also part of the solution is like actually becoming part of the government, right? And so I see this in my own research, the power that Black people have once they become part of the state, right? So we're thinking about this administration and their response, but we also have to think about what the previous administration did, right? So when there was no legal recourse through the courts, through this sort of the state or the local level, we had a Department of Justice who was bringing some type of federal hate crimes or some type of federal investigation that could be an avenue for recourse. And so I don't know, I think part of it is that we have to recognize that the state, there is potential to solve a lot of our problems, right? Through the state, becoming a part of the state and not necessarily.
But I agree with you in some ways. I mean, I also think it speaks to the complicated nature of the state, right? Because the state is multivocal, because it's the state that's shooting these people in the back, you know? So in some ways, when you think about like the state being the solution, it's like alcohol, the cause of and solution to all your problems.
Well, you know, guys, like, you know, not to step in. Okay, I am going to step in. You know, what this, I think that what this reminds us of, I think, is that, you know, we own, people only seem to really, really mobilize or like, or note the sort of violent nature of the state, you know, whether it's real violence or symbolic, you know, when we have these spectacular moments, right? You know, where you have the actual literal end of Black life, right? And, you know, whereas not so much, you know, in the other sort of quotidian ways in which Black life is undervalued, right? Which, you know, that reminds me of that, you know, the New York Times piece last week that was basically looking into Chetty et al.'s research on Black males in particular and earnings inequality. I mean, I think that that's, you know, an example of what, you know, James is talking about in terms of, you know, of the United States being a racial state, not just in terms of governance and government, but also I think in terms of like pretty much every single realm of our existence.
I just want to jump in here and say two things in dealing with the previous comments and then moving forward to this this current research. And in one sense, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, that I am sympathetic and empathetic in the way that we sort of run local governments. If you look at any major city, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, that you will notice that 70% of city budgets go to fire safety and pensions. And the reason that I'm bringing up this statistic is that once you start taking a closer look, you will find that everybody's under pressure and there are not that much in terms of money and resources. And especially as you have people who are resistant to paying taxes to sort of improve living conditions, that there are just not that many resources to sort of do innovative programming or to sort of encourage people to run for office where they have some political power to make, you know, qualitative changes to the state. What I'm saying here is that everybody's under pressure, the social workers, the teachers, the law enforcement, the people who live in these communities. And so there is this sort of tension, and you can feel it just walking in the street when you deal or walk in these spaces. And concerning the research about Black men and boys, I think one of the things about this case, the Stephon Clark case, and tying it into this current conversation, is that the sad part is, it wasn't shocking. It wasn't anything that I didn't know. And I feel that there is this sort of gaze that we're responding to try to keep telling people who are non-Black or people who hold anti-Black sentiment that racism exists and that this problem, it penetrates all facets of life. And I think we, you know, as much as the evidence year after year, month after month, week after week, that I can show somebody that inequality exists, especially along racial lines, is that there's always some sort of pushback. And so I guess there is a frustration on my part in thinking about what are the viable solutions and what things would need to be put in place for, you know, that if, you know, city budgets and resources are tapped out, or if I've known that since we started keeping statistics and records, that this has been the narrative for Black men and boys, and even more so for Black women and girls, how do we start having a conversation about how do we combat sort of interactional microaggressions, institutional racism, or dealing with what I think is a huge problem in this country, anti-Black sentiment, where anybody can get in on it. And even those who sort of harbor some sort of self-hatred or insecurity holding anti-Black sentiment. And I think this is sort of the challenge, that it's not only whites who feel this way, but it's an entire society that feels entitled to the success of not only Black professionals, but the well-being of Black people in general. So I think there's a, it's one of those things that's sort of disturbing, that now that I'm getting older in life, I sort of know how these things are going to end. And I think right now I'm trying to interrogate the narrative in such a way to sort of point out that not only has this been the case historically, but I think we need to start using different strategies and tactics to see that this is an institutional problem, and thinking about things like anti-Black sentiment an anti-Black racism that seems to disproportionately affect Blacks compared to other ethnic minorities.
I definitely agree with Waverly. So I think part of it is like thinking about changing the narrative about how we talk about race, right? So as a sociologist, I was interested in this data when it came out, but I was also interested in how people understood this data. And so you can sort of observe a split, right? And so you have those who are not necessarily engaged in anti-racist research, and it's like, oh, this is really groundbreaking findings. And then you have those on the other side who are doing this work, who've been in the trenches, and it's like, well, this isn't anything new. But part of it, I think, if we can sort of realize racism as something that is systemic, institutional, and structural, maybe we should follow Ibram Kendi's advice and maybe stop talking about racial progress or the lack thereof, but really trying to center our analyses and discussions around racist progress, right? This is how far racism has come. Mm-hmm. This is how it's progressing. That being said, I want to go back to something that Leslie said, thinking about Black death as something that is mobilizing action. So, you know, I can't control how others see the situation, but I can control how I respond, right? So I can't help how whites think about racism, but as a Black person, as a Black community, we can do whatever we can do. So I think part of it is that what is it about Black death that mobilizes, but not like in this way, Black life? So Chetty's he had this really interesting research, and he's doing this Equality of Opportunity Project based out of Stanford and Harvard. And so they had these findings that came out in the Times a few weeks ago, but also a few months ago, he also had research on what they were calling the lost Einsteins, right? And so what they found is that low-income mm-hmm. students who are among the best, very best math students in the country, those who score in the top 5% of all third graders, are no more likely to become inventors than below-average math students from affluent families. Right. And so to me, I don't know, when I'm seeing I think back to Stephon Clark, it's that these people, you're killing potential, right? And so why aren't we mobilizing around Black life mobilizing around getting resources to these communities, just not criminal justice reform? And I don't want to sort of minimize what this really robust movement has been about. But what if we're sort of changing this narrative about getting more resources, not just reforming a sort of a racist system, but one in which we can really harness the innovation and ingenuity of Black life?
Although, I mean, I wonder if in some ways I feel like the Black Lives Matter kind of provided that sort of umbrella sort of movement, right? That lets you talk about, you know, police shootings. I mean, and that was the entree onto the national stage, but it also felt like it was as much about you know, wealth inequality and why, I mean, it could be, it has that caring capacity to sort of talk at both ends of okay, you know, you can use it to have a conversation about, you know, the police shooting people in the back, but you can also use it to have a conversation about, you know, Black girl joy, right? Or Black boy joy, right? It's sort of, it's broad enough to carry that. And I guess to some extent, I do wonder if these conversations aren't all happening. Mm-hmm. And then the question just becomes is anyone listening or who's listening? Because in some ways I feel you know, I mean, the Chetty stuff, it's actually an excellent illustration. It's great work, and it's important that it's being done, and that's awesome. But it's also people have been saying that, Black scholars have been saying this from jump, you know? And so it's why are we acting like this is new?
No, it's true. No, you're totally right. They're give us empirical evidence. Give us empirical evidence. And you're okay, here's some empirical evidence. And they're okay, now give us some more empirical evidence, right?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess it does feel I don't know. I mean, I guess this is, I don't know, we just turn into the dark side, not the B side, right? But I've been feeling a lot lately of what is it going to take to, you know, really have this conversation? Because it seems you know, we're reaching a point of regression, where it's actually just like having a conversation about racism is like, is that okay? That's the question we're asking. Is it okay to talk about this, or will people feel, racist people feel offended if they're called racist? You know, it's like the conversations we're having is like, should we be talking about genetic inferiority or not? And it's like, wait, what the fuck? When did this happen? Like, this all came out of nowhere. Yeah, I know, right?
Like, Omarosa, I mean, Omarosa was like, I did not call him a racist because that shut down conversation. James, you wanted to say something?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
That was me, Waverly Duck.
No, James' hand was up.
I guess I'm just going to jump in really quickly. I mean, I think one of the things that I think is why I will say what I think is really important about Black scholars or scholars in general to continue to work on inequality is that, yes, we are regressing. That what has happened in terms of dismantling and privatizing schools, what's happening with the war on drugs and mass incarceration, what's happening with welfare reform, what's happening in terms of low wages, and even, you know, that I think this is a major issue, the regression of voter rights, that, you know, these ID laws on the surface may look, you know, that, oh, I have to, you know, show my ID to buy a beer, but even the type of identification becomes even somewhat what's allowed in terms of marginalizing people's right to vote, or even closing down DMVs or in proximity to Black folks. And so looking at the ways that modern racism continues to work, I think is really significant and important if you're ever going to have a conversation. But at the same time, again, there is a part of me when I see these studies, I'm like, okay, you know, I've seen that before. What's happening right now at this moment that's actually preventing my ability to thrive and survive? And I think in all of those domains, whether it's in the economy, whether it's in education, whether it's in law, or whether it's simply, you know, having access to vote, I think you're seeing poor and marginalized white communities and communities of color being put on notice. And there's almost like a full assault in terms of how these communities navigate, how they have political representation. So I think it's still important to sort of do this work, but I also think it's important to see how racism is working in these different domains when we say it's such a part of the fabric of America.
Well, you know, Waverly, you know, in talking about what it takes to thrive, I don't know if any of you saw that Root piece that came out. I think it was on Wednesday of last week by Corey Townsend about Tyrone Hankerson Jr.
Tyrone the scammer. The call is coming from inside the house. We spent 40 minutes blaming white folks, but here we go, Tyrone.
No, but you know what? But here's the thing. In reading this piece, like I was thinking about this piece as part of the larger protest that's going on right now, even as we speak. I think today is day number 6 or day number 7, right? Of you know, sort of the taking over of the administrative building at Howard. You know, with this idea that, you know, the administration has been milking students, you know, and also the institution itself for a long time. We are not having it anymore. We are going to take over until something is done, you know, not just in terms of this, but we have a list of all of these other demands. And then Corey Townsend comes up with this piece about Tyrone in his furs. And my question is, was I wrong or was that right of Corey Townsend to, you know, to sort of inject, you know, this kind of, you know, exhibit number one, let's look at this undergraduate and his malfeasance?
For any listeners who don't know, we should maybe give a little outline of it, right? So what, 6 employees from the financial aid office were fired for misappropriating university grants. And Tyrone Hankerson Jr. Has allegedly scammed $429,000.
He did it legally.
There are legal scams.
There's right. No, allegedly. No, that's what I'm saying. He said he did it.
Oh, Oh, well, I don't. Well, I'm going to say allegedly because I have not seen police reports. And, you know, who knows? Tyrone got a story too. Tyrone, if you want to be on the podcast, let us know. We are happy to provide a platform. But it does come in the wake of actually a few other, I guess, negative PR stories, you could describe them, where the Howard University folks have been not having good looks when it comes to, you know, student relations, but also in terms of how they're handling financial aid and housing. I mean, DC is such an expensive housing market that, like, the school has to kind of provide a safety net for students who want to go to school living in the area. And so, yeah, this story about the folks in the financial aid office has, I think, become a platform for a much deeper frustration in these protests that Leslie was talking about, for sure. But yeah, Tyrone, I know these fur coats are, yeah, it's really, it's something. And his international travel, I mean, he's kind of told on himself via Instagram.
So there's the reason I'm laughing, I mean, it's not funny. And I totally get why the people are protesting. I mean, college is expensive and surviving is hard. And I think one of the things when I first read this story, being at a predominantly white institution where every financial form is looked over 3 and 4 times and I can't even spend my own research funds, that no one thought it was odd that he was getting excessive amounts of grants and scholarships and even checks coming back to him. And I mean, and I speculate, nobody knows the future, but if I was a betting man, before this is all said and done with, and maybe here's an ASA drink, I'm going to bet that he's going to jail. Tyrone is going to jail. And if Tyrone is not locked up by the end of this year, I will buy everyone drinks.
You got to figure, though, it's going to be in Howard's interest to make this go away. And sending Tyrone the scammer through very public criminal proceedings is probably not something they want to do.
If the president loses his job, and I imagine that there's going to be a complete turnover in financial aid. I mean, I just there's a part of me where I've seen academics who misappropriated, you know, anywhere under $1,000 to get in trouble. But almost $500,000, you know, stuff like that just doesn't happen without some craftiness, if you know.
I mean, look, it was obviously a network of people, or 6 of them, who got fired. So this was like everybody, I don't know how big the financial aid office is at Howard, but my guess is 6 people is a nice chunk of the folks who work there. So it obviously, there was some kind of coordination going on, but I'm not convinced that, I mean, yeah. I'll be curious as to whether or not, like, how common this kind of stuff is across the board. Like, I don't know if this is just, like, I've read some stuff that suggests, like, this is a Howard problem, and it's indicative of, like, institutional failures at Howard and how they run the place. But I'm not convinced that this probably isn't, they're probably Tyrone the scammers at all kind of institutions who are like, let me get it right now because Tyrone and fuck it up for all of us.
I love how you formalized his name, Tyrone the scammer.
Hey, what I'm most curious about is hearing Tyrone justify his scamming as legal. I want to know what loopholes actually exist out there that make it okay to, in your little undergrad, like, you know, part-time job, making, you know, almost $500,000. So,
well, the scam goes something like this, right? Like, you sort of have more grant money coming in than you have tuition owed. And so then you get, like, the reimbursement. So, you know, you give yourself a university grant of $30,000. Your tuition only costs $24,000. And so then now you have a $6,000 surplus in your account and you get a check, right? So I'm sure there's, like, on paper, something that looks vaguely legitimate.
He went a step further. Money to study abroad, low income scholarships. He, whatever he felt he qualified for, he made sure he got those funds.
And Tyrone is like, look, I read the Chetty et al. Research in the New York Times, and I am not trying to be out here not accumulating
wealth. Well, so. You know, I mean, part of me doesn't want to be mad at Tyrone, right? But then part of me is like, seriously, bruh. I mean, think about your brothers and sisters who were undergraduates there at Howard who are struggling. Right.
And I mean, I remember I really wanted to go to Howard when I was in high school. I looked up the dorms, like, I'm going to live in Drew Hall. And then I got my letter from Howard, and then I opened it up, I got in, and then I was like, Mom, I got a full scholarship. She's like, no, baby, that's all your loans. And like, so like, that really affects people when you can't go to school and like they're messing with financial aid.
Yeah.
Like living in DC is incredibly expensive. Corey, Leslie, you live there. I live there. I lived a stop away from Howard. And it is not cheap. And it's also in a very gentrifying neighborhood.
Right.
And just to say, like, you know, this also happens at like white institutional spaces. At Columbia, there was a similar scam that was busted 3 months ago. And they were accused of taking about $400,000. But I think what makes it particular about Howard is this, like, again, this is this institutional failure. So, you know, like they have had unsteady leadership, both by their president, but also there's like chaos on their board. And so it's just a crisis overall. And then to exacerbate this by taking financial aid money to look like, you know, to be like the Instagram model or your Man Candy Monday. It's like, you know, it's problematic.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder, like, to what extent. So I was in a car service, I won't name. And like the driver was like, oh, talk to me. He was like, oh, this Howard scam and blah, blah, blah. And he was, it's interesting. So I was like, oh, did you go to Howard? He was like, no, but you know, it's like, it's all of our schools. When this happens at Howard, it's all of us. And I was kind of like, that's an interesting question. Like, I'm not sure how closely I feel like this is, you know, like my story or like, it doesn't quite kick in my politics of respectability alarm. I'm just sort of like, yeah, it's like Tyrone the scammer. They need to get their house in order over at Howard. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure I need to come out of pocket with a donation to a school I didn't go to about this one.
Okay, well, on that note, Corey, gentlemen, sadly, our time has come to an end. I'm sorry to be the
person doing it.
I know. I know.
We can go on about Tyrone the scammer for hours.
Well, Corey and I would like to thank our guest, Waverly Duck of the University of Pittsburgh, and James Jones of Rutgers University, New York, for a more than stimulating conversation today. We'd also like to thank our young producers out of Queens College, Anika Chowdhury and Joshua Riviera, for all they do. You can find the B-side along with her sister programs at sociocast.org. And you can also tweet Corey. Corey, what's your handle?
I'm Corey B. Field. Yeah, at Corey B. Field. And we'll get up a B-side Twitter account.
Yeah.
So you can tweet us there too. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you again, Waverly and James. And taking you out, here's that A-side track to push it. Spoiler alert, it is Tramp. See you all next. See you all next week.
Bye.
Have you ever seen a dude who's stupid and rude? Whenever he's around, he dogs your mood. I know a guy like that, girl. He thinks he's God's gift to the world. You know that kind, excited all the time, with nothing but sex on the mind. I'm no stunt, on me he can't front. I know the real deal, I know what they want. It's me.
Why?
Because I'm so sexy.
It's me.
What? Don't touch my body,
boy.
Cause you see, I ain't no skeezer. But on a real tip, I think he's a
tramp. What you call tramp? Tramp. What you call
tramp? Tramp. This is getting ridiculous. I'm gonna waste my time.
On the first date, he thought I was a dummy. He had the nerve to tell me he loved me. But of course, I knew it was a lie, y'all. He undressed me with his eyes.